pretty much knew right when you hit it if it was good or not. Nothing better than hitting a game winner, getting to celebrate. No worse feeling, though, than missing one, too. I played soccer growing up all the way up until I was 18. Then I grew up in Florida, and so soccer was a winter sport in Florida. So you could play both football and soccer at high school. Longest in a game was 61 when I was with the Cardinals. That was the fake field goal. We had it up for like 5 weeks, and we had called it twice before that. And we didn't get the right look, so we checked out of it, kicked the field goal. We finally got the right look.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming tonight. Jay and family, thank you for coming. We're just so much looking forward to hearing from you and learning about your experiences, what it's like to be in the NFL and the ups and downs and what it's taught you, and even beyond that, what the Lord has done in your life and through you. And so we're just so grateful for the time. Before we begin tonight, let's go ahead and look to the Lord in prayer, and then we'll do sort of a question and answer in which I'll give you questions and you can field them and you can just run with it as you would like to. Lord, thank you tonight for your goodness in our lives. I thank you for bringing Jay and his family here. Pray that you would just encourage us through him and him through us. We thank you, Lord, for your graciousness in our lives. I pray that we'd have joy tonight as we gather together. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
All right. Your dad put together a tribute to you online. I don't know if you've seen that or not.
Yeah, I did. It was pretty long.
Okay. Kind of slow moving.
That's
I might
right.
have played it otherwise, but kind of slow moving. But it started out with a particular statement, and he called you a man of God. And I thought that was just really profound that he was willing to say that, a family man and a father and a man of God and an athlete. And you made a comment when you were being interviewed one time about the fact that you're gifted, you know, God has given you opportunities. You felt like it was a responsibility to use, you know, your position. Mm-hmm. And tell me about that a little bit, or us about that.
Well, you know, I've heard people say, Charles Barkley being one, that it's not an athlete's responsibility to be a role model. Mm-hmm. You know, that it's a parent's responsibility, which is true. It is a parent's responsibility, first and foremost, to be the role model for your kids and to be the role model for maybe even not only your kids, but extended family and people that are in your life. But I think as an athlete, I always felt like you were given a platform. Mm-hmm. And right or wrong, you were given this platform and people were going to listen to you and look up to you. Mm-hmm. And you could have an impact on somebody's life. And I felt like that was the greatest opportunity and advantage that God had ever given you. Mm-hmm. You know, that it wasn't financial, that it wasn't, you know, any of these material things, that it was this platform that you'd been given that you can have an impact on somebody's life just by a small amount of effort. You know, by taking the time to talk to somebody, or taking the time to reach out, or going to a church and talking, or, you know, going to a school and getting an opportunity to talk. And a lot of times in schools, you know, teachers aren't allowed to talk about their faith at all. But they bring a speaker in, and you can say anything you want. You know, and you can talk about your faith, and they really can't stop you, especially in public schools. So I always felt like that platform that God had given you was the greatest advantage of being a professional athlete, and that it was my obligation and my desire, really, to take advantage of that and to use it as much as I could.
Sure, okay. Let me read some numbers to you.
I'm not a numbers guy.
Okay. 28 for 28, and 42 for 43, and 32 for 33, and 40 for 40. And 43 for 43, 38 for 38, 26 for 26, 39 for 39.
So it must be extra points. Certainly not field goals. I wasn't that good.
Yeah. And on total for your field goals, it was of attempts, 452 attempts, you made 449.
For extra points, yeah.
For extra points. What do you think of when you hear those kind of numbers?
That it was a lot easier now or then than it was than it is now. You know, once they changed the extra point rule, I think you've seen a lot of extra points. A few weeks ago, they had 12 missed extra points in one weekend, which was the most ever. And, you know, people talk about why, you know, because it's not that hard to make a 33-yard field goal. Mm-hmm. But I think pressure is a big thing, and pressure is cumulative. And so when you miss a kick, it builds throughout the year. So you miss, before when you weren't missing any extra points, you'd miss maybe 4 field goals in a season, 5 field goals. Now you miss 4 or 5 field goals, but you also miss 4 or 5 extra points. Now you're missing 8-10 kicks in a season, and every one of those misses builds upon itself, and that pressure continues to build and to multiply. And I think that's the hardest thing about being a kicker, is not necessarily the job, the physical nature of the job, but the pressure of the job. And it's probably harder on a wife than it is even on the player playing, on the family, because, you know, they're sitting up there in the stands and they have no control, and they know that if you have a bad game that you could be fired and cut this week, and that you're going to have to sell your house and you're going to have to move your kids and take them out of school. And there's always a lot of uncertainty that goes along with it. And I think that's where your faith comes in. And I think that for kickers in particular, I don't think it's a coincidence that the majority of kickers in the NFL are strong Christians. I think that the fact that you have a strong faith, that who you are is not defined by your success or your failure, by your makes or your misses, leads to success in that position. You know, so a guy who doesn't necessarily have a strong faith, he may be good, and he may be good enough, and there are guys for sure that are not Christians. But the guy who has a strong faith, that has a foundation that's not rooted in success, but rather in Christ, and that's there when he makes kicks and when he misses kicks, I think that helps him to succeed and helps him to handle the pressure and helps him to handle the failure, because that's really what it's about. It's about the ups and downs, the ebbs and flows in kicking, and the ability to do your job even when you've made mistakes and messed up on a huge stage prior to that.
I'm talking about less than perfect games. I don't know how many people here had seen the Saturday Night Live. I'm not going to play it or whatever, but
sure.
After a particular game, they kind of roasted you or
they
toasted
did,
you.
Yeah.
Tell me about that whole thing.
Well, we went out to Seattle, and it was in December, I think 2005. So we had just had Abigail. There's Abby. Raise your hand, Abby. We just had Abby, so she was a little baby. And had colic and cried all day, every day for like the first year that she was born. So it was a chaotic time at home anyways. But I was with the Giants. We were playing for home field advantage. We went out to Seattle. I was actually having the best year of my career up until that point. I was leading the league in every category, field goals made, field goal percentage, you name it. And having a great year, and went out there and had a really good game. Had made two kicks in the game and had a game winner. I think it was about 40 yards. And wanted to hit it left center because the wind was blowing right, and hit it exactly where I wanted, and the wind took it a little bit left, and it missed by about a foot left. So we went to overtime, and I got a 54-yarder after that in overtime, and I was short on that. I kind of knew going in that I wasn't going to make that kick. It was pretty long that day. And then I had, I believe, a 48-yarder, something like that, 47, 48, to win it again. So I had three game-winning kicks that I missed. And then they went down and kicked a field goal and won the game. And that was hard. It was really hard. I was heartbroken for my team and my teammates, obviously, to fail that many times in a row. I think the third field goal was the only kick that I could say that I missed in my career because I was nervous, because I was fearing failure. I was afraid that I would miss again rather than knowing that I was going to succeed. And for a kicker or any athlete, or somebody that's, you know, going for a big interview, I think if you're afraid of failure, that inhibits you from being the very best that you can be. And you have to go into it knowing that you're going to succeed, not hoping that you're going to succeed. And that was the one kick that I could say that I was hoping I would make it, and fearful that I would miss, and I missed. And so we flew home, and I'll never forget Monday morning. I was driving into the stadium. I knew that was going to be an awful day, because you're going to go in, you're going to watch all the film with your team. Every player you look at, you know that they're thinking, if you had just done your job, we would have won this game. And the difference between a winning locker room on Monday and a losing locker room is night and day. It's like total gloom if you've lost, and nobody's smiling, and everybody's walking around with their head down. In a winning locker room, everybody's joyful and running around and patting each other on the back, and you know, it's just these big swings. And so, you know, when you look at everybody and you see that they're sad and down, that was your fault, you know, that you didn't do your job. And so the last thing I wanted to do Monday morning was listen to the radio and listen to them talk about how awful I was and how I should be cut and run out of town. And I was on the cover of every paper in New York. And in New York, the media is four or five times what it is anywhere else. And so I actually had a CD that my wife had given me, and it was a Jeremy Camp CD that I had never listened to. And I undid it and put it in and just felt like, okay, I'll listen to this. And the very first song said, when you can't see me, you will not fear. When you can't hear me, You will not fear. I will trust in you, and I will not be afraid. Something of that nature. And just hearing those words in that song, you know, really spoke to me. You know, because at that moment, it was hard to see God's purpose and a plan, you know, in missing and failing. It was hard to trust in Him that He had, you know, my best at heart at that moment. You know, when you fail as bad as you can in those moments, it's hard. You know, it's hard for all of us. And yet, I think God gives us little reminders and things, just like a song and a verse in a song, or somebody stepping alongside you to give you encouragement that can be exactly what you need to hear at that moment. And I went in and had a good week of practice, was getting ready for the next game, and Saturday night I was trying to go to sleep, and I got about 50 text messages on my phone from all my friends, and it was like, dude, they're killing you on Saturday Night Live right now. And I had no idea they were going to do a skit about me. Okay. It wasn't like they call and ask your permission.
Sure.
They just do it. And it was Dane Cook playing me, and it was what it was like to ride on the plane home from Seattle after the game. Mm-hmm. You know, so they had fun at my expense. Now, the ironic thing is that the next day we played Philadelphia, and I had four field goals in that game, three during the game that I made. We went to overtime again, and they called timeout, and I had another field goal to win it in overtime, and they called timeout to ice me. And they played a montage of my misses up on the Jumbotron during that timeout in the city of brotherly love. Uh-huh. And, you know, I will never forget that moment, and sitting there praying and just asking for God's peace. You know, Paul talks about the peace that transcends all understanding. Mm-hmm. You know, why you would have a peace at that moment, I don't know. Because I shouldn't. I should have been nervous. I should have been thinking about the implications. You know, if I miss that kick, I'm going to get cut. I'm going to get fired. I'm probably not going to get another job with the team. My career is probably going to be over. It totally changes the whole dynamics of our family, our life, the direction of our life, the financial outcome of our life. I mean, all those types of things. And yet, I had a peace at that moment, and I was able to just focus on my job at hand and the fundamentals of what I was doing, head down, lock my ankle, follow through, and not be worried and consumed with all those ancillary things that were going to deter me from doing my job. You know, and I think that's what Paul is talking about. You know, a peace that you shouldn't have in those moments, peace that transcends all understanding. And yet I did have that peace, and I was able to make that kick and, you know, and go on from there. And the interesting thing is, from that game forward, from the Seattle game when I missed those three game winners forward, I didn't miss another game winner for the next 10 years of my career. I had one that was tipped and blocked, but I didn't miss a kick. I also was a much better kicker after that game than I was before that game. And I think it's because I failed as bad as I could fail, on as big a stage as I could fail on. And everybody saw it and laughed at it and had fun with it, and it didn't break me. And going forward, I knew that it took away a lot of the fear of failure. I wasn't as afraid to mess up and to make a mistake as I was before, because I've already been through the worst, and it didn't break me, and God was there for me, and I did have that peace, and I was able to continue forward. And you realize that in those moments of failure, they're not as big as you think they are. They're not as life-defining as you think they are. That life does go forward, and you are able to make it through, and God does lift you up and provide sustenance in those moments. And it helped me going forward in my career to be a much better kicker.
Well, Paul says in Romans 5 that tribulation works patience, and patience endurance. And that's
my wife would attest that I still need to work on patience. That was one of my New Year's resolutions, okay. Too.
Looking at stats, NFL.com, whatever, just looking through the 14 years, right?
14 years,
13
yes.
And a half, or how did that
14.
Work out? 14,
yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Words like amazing and incredible and awesome, you know, would certainly come to mind. What do you attribute that to, that you were so successful?
Well, I would honestly say a little bit of luck and a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And a lot of perseverance. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that I wasn't the best kicker in the NFL, not by any means. I never had the strongest leg. I didn't get into the NFL right away. I spent 2 years out working. I got a job as a financial advisor. Rebecca was working. She made the bread for a while at the beginning before we had kids. And I was continuing to work out and go after my dream, and I had support from my family and mm-hmm. continued to do it. And for 2 years, those doors shut. The first 2 years after I kicked at Michigan, you know, we won the national championship at Michigan, and I thought I would have an opportunity to go right into the NFL, and that didn't happen. And I would go to tryouts, and I would kick really well, and nothing would happen. You know, I wouldn't get any offers, and I would call Rebecca up after a tryout, like, for sure they're going to sign me. I kick better than everybody here. Can't kick any better, and then nothing would happen, and I wouldn't get signed. So for 2 years, I continued to work and work at it, and finally, I went to one last tryout. I was ready to quit. She was pregnant, I believe, or we just had a baby, actually. We just had Lexi, and in 2001, we just had Lexi, my oldest, and I was working. We had a baby at home. I was trying to work out, and I was ready to say, okay, it's not going to happen. It's been 2 years. So I went to one last tryout, and it was like God said, okay, now I'm going to open those doors, and I'm going to open them so wide that you're going to have to know that I was the one that did it, not you. And I got three or four different offers from different teams, mm-hmm. and I was able to kind of pick the team that I thought I would have the best opportunity to make the team. So I went up to Atlanta with the Falcons. I got no money to sign. My signing bonus was $0. But I got to compete against another rookie. And I went in and ended up beating him out and was lucky that that he got injured about a halfway through training camp and wasn't able to kick for a few games. That gave me the opportunity to kick for all those games and kicked well and ended up making the team and winning the job and then kind of going on from there. But I think that you have to be ready when your opportunity comes. You know, you don't ever know when that opportunity for that dream and that goal that you have, and you have to be prepared and you have to be ready. So you have to do your part. And secondly, you have to trust God and know that he's going to open those doors for you and trust him even when those doors don't open. You know, because it would be very easy to get mad at God and to quit and to give up. But so working as hard as you can and being prepared for opportunity, trusting in God even when those doors don't open. And then when they do open, being ready to go through them and to do your very best. And you know, so I would say that a little bit of luck, a lot of work, and a lot of faith.
Sure. Florida Bobcats, how does that fit into the whole thing?
I try to forget that.
Oh,
that's the Arena League. I did that. I did a couple games with the Florida Bobcats and hurt my leg, and then I did one game with the Tampa Bay Storm the next year, and then they cut me after one game. You know, it was a humbling beginning, that's for sure.
Okay. Wow. Okay. How about these numbers? 55, 52, 46, 47, 52, 47, 53, 55. 61, 52, 48, which would be your longest.
It was the longest for each year.
Yeah.
It was interesting because I got stronger as I got older. Mm-hmm. You know, the 55, mm-hmm. 61, that was towards the end of my career. And, I think there's a good metaphor in that. You know, we think that we have to work as hard as we can and do everything as hard as we possibly can. And yet you're better when you are at, say, 80% and you're smooth. And when I was young in my career, I would try and hit every field goal as hard as I can so that it would soar high and it would look really good. And, you know, everybody's excited with the long kick and, you know, but all that matters is it goes through the uprights, mm-hmm. you know. And so you learn to then kind of dial it back a little bit and stay at 80% because you're more consistent. And so, like, you saw the one field goal, I think it was against the Cowboys, that cleared by like two yards, you know, just went over the crossbar. I was totally fine with that at the end of my career. I didn't care if it looked pretty or not. If, you know, as long as it went in. I remember Morton Anderson talking about that at the end of his career. You know, and if he was at 40 yards, it would go over by about 2 yards. And if he was at 48 yards, it would go over by about 2 yards. And if he was at 55 yards, it would go over by about 2 yards. But, you know, I think that I got better as I got older. And part of that's because I stopped worrying about what people thought about me. You know, you stopped worrying about what a coach thinks, and you learn to put yourself in the position that's going to help you succeed. Whereas when I was young, I tried to fit into whatever picture a coach wanted me to fit into and prepare the way a coach wanted me to prepare. And when I got older, I realized I play my best when I have fun. And so if you watch me the last 5-6 years of my career, especially in warm-ups, I was like a 12-year-old boy let loose on a field, and they said, you can do anything you want to do. And I was playing catch. I was catching punts behind my back. I was doing all kinds of stuff that had zero to do with kicking. I'm talking to everybody. I'm talking to the other team. And it's funny because that really helped me when my career was over going into my next career in media because I've developed all these relationships because that's my natural personality, though, is to be friendly and to be talkative and to have fun. And when I was able to trust myself to do that and not care what other people thought, then I performed a lot better.
Hmm. Wow, very good. You mentioned coaches. Which coach would you respect the most and have the most appreciation for?
Well, I would say my grandfather, who coached college basketball for over 30 years, who had never actually coached me per se on a team, but he was always my biggest coach and the guy that I talked to all the time. He would call and leave me messages all the time. Jay, it's your grandpa. Why haven't you called me this week? What, are you mad at me? You know? And I call him up, and we talk about, you know, the game plan and what was going on or what happened at practice or, you know, but he was always there for me and a guy that I really respected who achieved a lot both playing and then coaching and was the greatest competitor. He was 72 before he got beat by any of his kids or grandkids in tennis for the first time. And, I mean, this is a guy who had kids who played tennis in college, you know, and they still couldn't beat him. I mean, he was just a great competitor and taught me a lot about competing and about family and how important family was. And I think the best lesson he ever taught me was after that Seattle game. And, you know, when you fail, you have an opportunity to define how you respond to that failure. Sure. And I'm sitting in my locker afterwards and just heartbroken that I missed this kick. And you got guys coming by kind of patting you on the back, you know, hey, it's all right. And yet you know that you were the one who lost that game. And a lot of guys will get dressed real quickly and get out of that locker room as fast as they can because they don't want to deal with it. They don't want to talk to me. But they're happy to stay around and talk when they win the game, right, because they want to do all the press conferences and all the interviews. And so I didn't get out of there quick, and I got dressed, and they said, hey, you know, all the media's in there. Will you come in and do the – and it was something like this right here. And you get up in front, and you know that they're going to – dissect, you know, your worst moment and your biggest failure. And it was no fun. But I remember him calling me up afterwards, you know, and he was like, Jay, I've never been more proud of you than in that press conference and how you handled it and the way that you were a man about it and you didn't shy away from it. And, you know, that's the right way to approach it. And, you know, I just think that he taught me probably more than any coach. You know, and I had a lot of great coaches. My coach in high school was my best man at my wedding, and you know, for Rebecca and I. And that was another guy that taught me a ton. And he taught me most about the way that you treat people, and really instilled in me a desire to care about people, especially special needs people. He took and he still does this. It's amazing. You know, he takes 30 to 40 of his football players for a week every summer to muscular dystrophy camp, and where you go and you volunteer for a week, and you know, kids who have muscular dystrophy have different levels of severity. You know, some need full care where you have to bathe them and they're in a wheelchair and you have to feed them, and some, you know, are young and they run around and you're just chasing them around. But he would take his players every summer, and I did this when I was in high school, and then my brothers did it when they were in high school, and then Rebecca actually went with me and was a counselor there as well, you know, after we met and got married. And, you know, but seeing a guy that I respected on the field who also took it off the field and had an impact on people's lives left a lasting impact on my life and the kind of person that I wanted to be.
And your dad was a coach also?
Yeah, my dad was a coach also. Okay. And, you know, obviously learned a lot, you know, from him and through him. And we had an up and down relationship our whole life. You know, if he were here, I'd say the same thing. You know, my parents got divorced when he was 13, mm-hmm. and he was an alcoholic for a while. But you know, has overcome that as well. And you know, I think you one of the things I learned most from him is that forgiveness is a great thing. That you need to forgive people for their mistakes, and it helps you as much as it does them.
Okay. And I think your mom is here too, right?
Yep, she is. So she's right there. She was great. She raised four boys by herself.
All right. Is it all right to ask about your brother then?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Sure.
You had one brother who was born with difficulties. You've mentioned it before, but
yeah, I've talked about him a lot. My brother Michael was we thought, you know, he was about a year and a half older than me, that he was normal, and then he had an allergic reaction to DPT shots. And then after he passed away, we found out that he had a condition called pachygyria, which is a brain maldeformity. But it basically left him the equivalent of a six-month-old. And, you know, the doctors at the time told him, this is back in the 70s, told my mom, you can leave him at the hospital and we'll take care of him until he dies. And, you know, she had a choice to make then. You know, do you listen to them or do you bring him home? And she said, well, I'm going to bring him home and I'm going to love him and take care of him as long as I have him. And he ended up living for 26 years, you know. And I think it's really interesting because the way that my mom reacted to that tragedy, you know, her son basically being taken from her, and the way that my dad did, led to where the path their lives went down. Whereas my mom was heartbroken but accepted it and trusted God and followed him, whereas my dad was mad at God, you know, and that led him down his path. And, you know, she took care of him and she took care of my brothers and I, four boys. And, you know, just loved Michael the same way she did the rest of us. And, you know, because of Michael and being around him all the time and seeing how God can use somebody whose life seems meaningless, you know, who lives in a bed, who can't communicate, who eats through a tube in his stomach and breathes through a tube in his throat, you know, and you look at him and you think that his life is meaningless, and then you see the impact that he has just by surviving. You know, my uncle became a pediatrician because of Michael. My cousin became a doctor and works at Rochester Mayo Clinic because of Michael. My brothers and I all got involved in the Muscular Dystrophy Association, Special Olympics, you know, because of Michael. My wife did as well. I mean, the trickle-down impact that he had on so many different people's life, including a young boy when I was at the national championship when I was playing for Michigan. You know, we were out in California playing for the national championship against Washington State. And they had a kickoff for kids' luncheon, and they asked guys to get up and speak, and there's three guys from each team, and I talked about Michael, and I talked about God. And after the game, after we won the game and won the national championship, and I went back to my hotel, and there's thousands of people there. I was trying to find Rebecca and my family, and a lady came up to me, and she asked me about my brother, and I got to sit down with her and her son, who was 10 years old and he had an operable brain tumor, and the doctors had given him less than a month to live. And he wanted to talk about my brother. And so amidst all the hoopla of a football game and winning a national championship, I got to talk to him about my brother and God's purpose and plan for each of our lives. And when I went to dinner that night, I couldn't help but think of how meaningless the football game was. But at that point, my brother was still alive, and he was having an impact on somebody else's life. And I just saw how God can use each of us for different and unique purposes, even somebody whose life seems meaningless.
Wow. Mm-hmm. All right. Players. How about other players that you like and look up to and are special?
Well, you know, there's so many. And, you know, the guys that I became very close with, most of them were Christian guys. You know, and early on in my career in Atlanta, we had about 10 couples. And we were young with a newborn and starting our career, and there was a lot of guys on that team that were young couples. We had a couples Bible study at our house. The pastor would come over, and he would host it. And he and his wife got pregnant at 40, even when he was hosting it. And I think their youngest at the time was like 13. So, that team and those guys, we were all really close, and we shared a faith, and obviously we shared a team as teammates, you know. But the majority of guys that I became very close with were guys that had a common faith, you know, because we were approaching life from the same perspective. We were making the same kind of decisions. Obviously, when you're on a football team and you're around a lot of young guys with a lot of money, some guys are making great decisions and some guys are making poor decisions. You know, we were just talking about it with our kids. Surround yourself with like-minded people. You know, pick your friends that are going to lift you up, not drag you down. You know, so if I'm going around with guys that are going out drinking, partying, cheating on their wives, well, that's what's going to happen. You know, but if you surround yourself with guys that are trying to live the same way that you are, and their wives are trying to live the same way that your wife is, well, then they're going to pick you up. And, you know, wherever we were, whatever team we were on, those were the guys that that we became friends with, the couples that we became friends with. And, you know, there's a lot of guys on a lot of different teams that I respected tremendously, but most of them had strong faiths.
Mm-hmm. just as a follow-up, how does a person of your stature, famous, whatever, maintain integrity in all those areas? How does that?
Well, I think whether you're famous or not, I think it's a struggle for all of us. I think it's a daily struggle, and mm-hmm. I think it helps to have a spouse who picks you up and you pick her mm-hmm. up. I think that you have to try to seek God on a daily basis and surround yourself with people that are going to mm-hmm. be an encouragement to you. Whether that's friends or pastors, I think a church that you like going to that is an encouragement. I mean, Delmont's here from Haiti. The only reason, one of the main reasons he's here is because the pastor in our church down in Phoenix walked up to me one day and was like, "Hey, do you want to come down to Haiti with me?" and next week. And Rebecca never thought I would say yes, and I was like, "All right, I'll go." And we went down and met him. He already knew my brother, but he was standing there waiting for me when I showed up, and he was like, "Are you Jay Feeney?" And we became really good friends, and then, 3 years later, he's living with us at our house and going to school up there. But, to go down to somewhere like Haiti and to have an impact on people who are in desperate need, who don't care what you do, that only care, "Hey, how can you help me?" That they might not have a house, they might not have food, but they're grateful for the things you have. I think that was probably my lasting impact, was sitting in church in the mountains of Haiti where these people don't have food and they don't have housing and, they're so desperate and yet they're grateful, mm-hmm. And we have so much and we have everything we want food-wise, shelter, and yet we're always complaining, and we always are upset about what we don't have. It's such a unique experience to listen to people who truly have nothing, who are honestly grateful for the very few things that they have. I think, that's one of the reasons my wife and I decided to bring our kids down there while we've gone on missions trips to try and have an impact, because we want them to see what real poverty looks like, because mm-hmm. we don't see that here in the United States. Mm-hmm. Even our poorest of poor are well off compared to, somewhere like Haiti.
Mm-hmm. And did you begin a mission agency to go down there? What's your involvement with the group?
Yeah, we didn't begin really anything. There's a group down there, Mission of Hope, that's been there for about 25 years, and we have partnered with them. My brother started going right after the earthquake. He had a friend who was running an orphanage. That orphanage got destroyed in the earthquake, and then he kind of partnered up with Mission of Hope, and my brother went down there and just worked for a week and kind of said, "Hey, I think it's somewhere that you would really like. They got a lot of need, and I think you should go down there." So we were planning a trip later that year, and when our pastor came up and asked me to go, and I kind of went for selfish reasons, to be honest with you. I went because I was scared to bring my family there, and I wanted to know what it was like before I brought my kids and my wife there. And I was so glad that I went, and so glad that I went with the people that I went with. The pastor that I went with of our church in Arizona and the associate pastor, they both grew up as missionaries' kids. Hmm. So they're absolutely crazy. Mm-hmm. Like, literally, we're in the middle of Port-au-Prince, and we have armed guards, and they're like, "Come on, let's go for a walk." And it's like 9 o'clock at night. And they're like, "Yeah, we're going to walk down to this gas station and get some food." And I'm thinking, like, we're going to die. Like, what are we doing? We are the only white people walking up to this gas station, and there's like 100 Haitians everywhere. And now we're going to go in the back of the gas station and eat chicken. So if the Haitians don't kill us, the chicken's going to kill us. And we were fine. And the chicken was good, and we had some ice cream back there. And I think they taught me a lot about just trusting God and not being consumed by fear and the unknown.
Hmm. Are you involved in raising funds for Mission of Hope?
Yeah, we do. We do a lot we have our own foundation, but we partner with a lot of different groups. Mm-hmm. We're building an orphanage down there, which is one of the things they went down, our church went down right after the earthquake, and they literally brought all these supplies, went through the Dominican, and had no idea who they were going to help or what they were going to help, and just said, like, "God, help us find the right people." They put a cross in tape on the front of their window and somehow got across the border through all security just by being like, "Yeah, we're with Red Cross." Mm-hmm. And they let him across, and they met this guy on the other side of the border, and he was like, "Can you please help me?" And they're like, "Yeah, we're here to help." And he said, "Well, I have a whole orphanage, and it totally collapsed, and we have all these kids sleeping under a tree." And so they rode with him right to his orphanage, and helped rebuild it on the spot that week and gave them food and care. And, I can't imagine what it was like down there right afterwards because there were limbs that were cut off. Delmont was there. He lived through it. His village got destroyed, and he slept on the roof of a house for 2 years because they didn't have a home and never said anything, kept going to work as a translator and working with people, helping to build homes, and yet his family didn't have a house. I think that has an impact on who you are and what you think and what you believe, and knowing, you know, the faith, seeing the faith that he had in God, not getting mad at him for 2 years, not having a house, not having food to eat, knowing that God was going to provide. I think that kind of faith is special.
Wow. You kicked for the Pat Tillman Foundation. Tell us about that. Was that an interesting day?
I think the Pat Tillman Foundation is awesome. I mean, obviously, they're trying to help soldiers and wounded warriors and people. Pat Tillman left the Cardinals. I wasn't a teammate of his. It was before me, but he decided after 9/11 that he couldn't continue to be an NFL player, that he wanted to go serve his country. And I think he had a $7 million contract that he walked away from and joined the Army Rangers and became a Ranger and then ended up dying in battle. And I think it was from friendly fire. But so they created the Pat Tillman Foundation, and we loved to help them, to support them. I was able to kick for them in a thing at the Super Bowl and raise some money, which was kind of cool. But really the cool thing is that every year, or almost every year, we go and run in the Pat Tillman race, and they have that in Phoenix. It's a 4.2-mile run. He was number 42 for the Cardinals, and so it's 4.2 miles, and then he played at ASU, so they stopped, they ended at the 42-yard line in Arizona State Stadium. And my wife, Rebecca, and I, family, friends, we go, and we have some friends of ours that are in a house, in a home called Hacienda, which is a home for physically and mentally disabled adults, young adults, and we get wheelchairs, and we push them in this race, and so we get friends to kind of help us do that, and it's kind of a cool way to not only run the race for the Pat Tillman Foundation and to honor him and his service to our country, but also to incorporate somebody else that doesn't necessarily get to get outside and to do fun things because they're in a wheelchair confined to, you know, their house, you know, this big, it's like a auditorium type place that they all stay. But a lot of times they don't get to leave there. They stay there and they don't get out much. So it's kind of cool to be able to bring them and do something fun with them.
Okay. Pitchers, and especially closers, are notorious for being superstitious. if they have socks on that they don't wash, they continue to do that. So they obviously have a whole mental perspective going on when they're doing their closing. It is what you do similar to that, and do you have... how do you keep your mind in focus?
Sure. I think closing in baseball is the most similar to kicking in football because you sit on the sidelines, you wait most of the game, and then you have to come in and win or lose the game. And, you know, it takes a special person to be able to do that. There are a lot of superstitions in kicking as well as closing. I was not one of them. I kind of I hated superstition, so I would do things like despite superstition.
Okay.
So I wore the socks from the Seattle game on purpose the next week, like despite superstition.
Sure. Yeah.
But, you know, for me, it was always about faith. It wasn't about superstition. You know, and I trusted in God and his plan and his purpose in my life rather than, you know, any superstitions. But I do think that, you know, closing and the ability to handle pressure is very similar to kicking.
Okay.
You know, and those guys, there's so many guys that can kick a ball 50 yards, you know, all over. You know, high school, college, guys that are done, you can find all kinds of guys. Same with baseball. There's a lot of guys that can go out there and they can throw a 90-mile-an-hour fastball, right? But can you do it when the game's on the line? Can you do it when there's all that pressure in that moment? I think that's what separates, you know, a lot of guys from the majority. You know, the very few who can consistently do it over and over with that kind of pressure are the ones that are going to succeed in professional sports. And like I said earlier, I think that it helps a lot to have a strong faith. There's a lot of baseball players that are pitchers that have a strong faith as well. You know, I mean, I was lucky early in my career to go to a Bible study in Atlanta with John Smoltz. You know, there was this eclectic group that met on Thursday mornings, and Jeff Foxworthy was one of the guys who went to that. Ernie Johnson, the TNT announcer, who I respect tremendously, was one of the guys. Ravi Zacharias, pastor, he would come every once in a while. So to kind of get, and I was young, and so to get to go and to sit amongst all these guys who were Christians who were the best in their fields, and to just kind of listen, was so cool. And John Smoltz was one of those guys, and at the time he was the best pitcher in baseball, and you know, the most competitive guy I've ever been around. Absolutely hated to lose, hated it, you know, with a passion, and loved to compete, everything, whether it was baseball, football, golf, table tennis, you name it. He wanted to be the best, and he wanted to win. And so I loved competing against him. You know, but at the same time, I saw somebody who I respected tremendously, who was so good at what he did, and was the best in the world at what he did, and was such a great competitor, but loved Christ at the same time. And I think we lose that. A lot of times we think, in, you know, that you can't be a man, and that you can't be this manly, competitive, strong man, and be a Christian at the same time, and that's just not true.
Good. Okay. Does it make a difference how inflated the ball is when you kick it?
I don't know.
This is a segue to
So Jace is actually doing a science project this year on ball inflations and how the pressure changes with different temperatures. So I may have to get back to you on the scientific results. But it definitely has an impact on how far you can kick a ball. If the ball is underinflated, you can't kick it as far. There's one game that I remember distinctly, and on our sidelines, the balls were underinflated, and we were kicking the balls, and our punter actually punted three times, and he was mad, and he was yelling about the balls. And their balls on the other side were nice and plump and inflated the right way. You know, so it has an impact for sure. It's the opposite of what a quarterback. You know, some quarterbacks, like they said, Brady liked them underinflated, and Aaron Rodgers liked them overinflated. Kickers, you would rather have them overinflated than underinflated because they wouldn't go near as far if they were underinflated. But the kicking balls are interesting because my rookie year in the NFL, they changed the rules because they used to take kicking balls and they would put them in the oven. They would put them in dryers. They would do all kinds of stuff to them to get them ready for a game because they wanted just to blow up and to be these plump balls that would fly. And they got mad about it, and so they changed the rules. So the kicking balls now go to the stadium in a sealed box.
Okay.
They're numbered 1 through 12. They have the game, so it says, like, game 1, Atlanta versus Seattle, ball 1, and it's got a big K on it and branded into it. And so that you know exactly what ball is supposed to be there for the kicking, and that they'll take, like, the first number 1 and number 2, and they'll just use those two balls. And they only get 30 minutes to break them in at the beginning with the referees in front of them. So now the quarterbacks, on the other hand, the NFL has told the quarterbacks for 15 years up until the whole Deflategate thing, you can do whatever you want to the balls. So they would get them during the week, and they would do mud baths, and they would take sandpaper to them, and they'd take them out in the grass and throw them. And these equipment guys would have all these different recipes, what to do with the balls, to get them exactly the way the quarterback wanted them. And then Friday, they'd bring in a whole bin of like 50 balls, and the quarterbacks would go through and feel them and, like, say, no, 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 okay, yes, this one. They pick out the 12 balls that they wanted. And so each team would bring their own 12 balls that they wanted to the game, and the quarterback got the exact balls they wanted. That's why that whole Deflategate thing is such, to me, is such a joke, because you've told the quarterbacks you can do whatever you want to those balls for 15 years. So.
Okay. And Tom Brady is a friend of yours.
Yeah, he is. And he was in our wedding. So okay. I know him well.
Okay.
And I feel like he was unfairly prosecuted or persecuted in that regard.
All right.
Yeah.
Were you involved in the process of adjudication or whatever? I'm not sure what it
was. I was there throughout the process not because I was a friend of his, but because I was with the NFL Players Association. And I've been on the board for almost my whole career, for about 14 years, and on the executive committee. So when we had to go before Judge Berman, who was doing the case, he was one of the mediating judges, and go into his courtroom, I was there and a part of that process and testifying. Because when I was with the Jets, something similar had happened with our ball boy, ironically against the Patriots. And he had brought a pad in to that 30-minute session when he could do something on the balls. And it was really to help his hand so that he wouldn't get blisters on his hand. but it was something that was not allowed in the rules, and so the Patriots complained about it. And he got in trouble for it, but I never got in trouble for it because I didn't have anything to do with it. So our point to the judge was, in this circumstance, you didn't blame the player when mm-hmm. somebody was doing something, but in the Patriots circumstance, you blamed Tom Brady. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the arguments that we used.
Okay. Who's going to win the Super Bowl this year?
Oh, if you asked me right now, I would say the Patriots.
Okay.
You know, my wife would say she would probably root against it. She's tired of the Patriots winning. Who would want to see the Patriots win? Anybody in here? Oh, we got a few. Okay. We got a few. You would want to see the Patriots? All right. There you go. The Packers, who would like to see the Packers win? I know we're in Packers territory. Lions, who about the Lions? We got about as many Packers fans as Lions fans. I'm surprised. Uh-huh. The Raiders, I think, losing Derek Carr, that's about it. I think it'll be Dallas Cowboys against the Patriots in the Super Bowl. I think that'll be a pretty good Super Bowl.
Okay. Easiest and hardest place to kick.
The hardest is an easy answer. There's three stadiums. It's Pittsburgh, Cleveland, and Chicago. Because they're outdoors and they're cold and they're grass. You know, Buffalo is another one that's hard to kick in, but they have turf, so at least you have good footing. And for a kicker, if you have good footing, that's half the battle. But when you have the outdoor stadiums and it's cold and snowy, like this weekend coming up, and it's grass, that's just brutal to kick in. Okay. And then any dome inside is the best because you don't have to worry about the wind, the footing's great. You know, it's just all on you to put the ball between the uprights.
Okay. Do you always look at the flags and is that?
Yeah, you know, you try and study it in certain stadiums. When I was with the Giants, that stadium was really hard because the winds always swirled a lot. And so I would literally go in there sometimes when they actually still, when you have turf, they'll still have the sprinklers on and sprinkle them every once in a while. And so I would go in there and just watch the way the wind would blow the water. You know, you could see, you know, when the sprinklers were going and it would kind of blow it. And you'd watch the different patterns. And they had, the wind was like this. You know, so if you were kicking, it'd be one way. But if you were punting, it would be the opposite way up above. Mm-hmm. And so we always felt like that was an advantage because we would know it better than the other guys would know it. But, different guys. Phil Dawson, who still is kicking, he's my age, he's still kicking for the 49ers. He has a notebook, and he would literally bring it out there and just take meticulous notes about wind and what it would do and conditions and all that kind of stuff. And I never got too focused on weather or wind. I didn't want to think about it. I just wanted to go out there and play. You know, I don't want to focus on all that during the week. It took away from my enjoyment and fun. And I knew like I had to have fun and enjoy it. And mm-hmm. I couldn't be worried about things that I couldn't control.
Mm-hmm. Good. What's the best part about being a pro football kicker?
The best part, I would say game winners. You know, I mean, hitting a game winner is the best part. And getting to have everybody run out there and celebrate and cheer and go crazy. And, mm-hmm. you know, you get to be the hero and you know, there's so many times, especially in the public, where the kicking position is kind of denigrated. Like, you know, they look down on it and talk down about it and feel like it's not really a part of the team. And that's such a great time where everyone just gets to celebrate and come out there and, you know, have fun. And, you know, I get to bring my son Jace down to the stadium one time, into the locker room after the game. That was pretty cool. To get to bring him down there and celebrate with him, with your son.
Okay.
Yeah, that was awesome.
The sports build character?
Absolutely. I think it builds it and it reveals it. Hmm. You know, I think there's a lot of guys that that don't have a lot of character, and you know that right away. You know which guys you can count on and which guys you can't, which guys are selfish, and what guys are team guys and care about you. And I think it builds it. Like I said about failure, you know, there's not a lot of places that you will fail like that and have to come back and succeed right away and put that failure behind you. And I think that builds character because we're going to fail all the time in life. We're going to fail as a husband in marriage. We're going to fail in business. You know, you look at all the great successes in business, you know, the course of our country's history, and most of them failed multiple times before they were successful. And mm-hmm. politicians like Abraham Lincoln who failed multiple times before they were successful. And I think that sports does a great job of preparing you for the realities of life. You're not always going to win. You're not always going to, you know, it's not just a participation medal. There's winners and losers in life, and you have to learn how to deal with that. You have to learn how to compete and how to fail and how to be a gracious loser and how to win and not be, not gloat and, you know, be somebody who brags and, you know, go about life the right way and be appreciative for your successes without being conceited.
What do you see for the future for the Feelies?
Well, you know, it's been fun. This transition to being an announcer has been a new challenge. I like it because it keeps me around the game. It's been tough in some ways for my family because especially this year I was gone for almost 3 months. You know, I was home for 2 days. I'd gone for 5 days doing games. And, you know, but now we get some time off and time to be alone and get to come up here for Christmas and then the summers as well. But you know, announcing was something that, you know, God kind of opened those doors. I never thought it was something I wanted to do until about halfway through my career. And all of a sudden I did it once and people said, hey, you're pretty good at that. And then I started thinking about it and kind of liked it. And my wife always joked with me because I'd kind of announce games while I'm sitting at home and they would say like the same thing right after me. And she would be like, you should do that someday. And then here I am doing it, you know. But again, you have to be ready for those opportunities because I was still playing and CBS called me and they said, hey, if you want to go, you know, when you got some time off and call a game, we'd be interested to hear you call a game. You know, I know you're a kicker and, you know, nobody's really ever done that before from that position. Mm-hmm. But we'd like to hear what you have to do. And so I did that. I went and honestly, I was scared to death that I would be awful. And I remember 2 minutes before I was going on to air, I'm sitting there thinking to myself, I have no idea what I'm about to do. But I'm going to be on TV for about 3 hours, so I'll have fun with it. And I did it, and I didn't know if I was awful or if I was great because it's so subjective. But I think it's something where, just like you know, any job in life, if you're willing to accept criticism, you can get better, and if you work hard at it. And so my whole thing with announcing is I tell them, the guys that are my producers are kind of like your boss that day. And my actual bosses, I tell them all the time, tell me everything I'm doing wrong. I don't need you to pat me on my back. You know, I got enough self-confidence. Tell me what I'm doing wrong because I want to get better. You know, I think too often in life we don't do that enough. My wife's looking at me. You want me to tell me what I'm doing wrong back so that I can get better?
Couple more questions.
All right, sounds good.
And then maybe if anybody has,
yeah, absolutely.
Maybe we'll see what happens here. Over the years, I got to know you 10, 12 years ago or whatever.
Started going to your Bible studies when, yeah, I was up here.
And I've been praying for you.
Thank
over
you.
The years, and
I appreciate
it's been a great privilege. I'd like for you to just tell them how a person can know the Lord. If, you know, that could be more important. It is more important,
sure,
than anything else.
Well, so, yeah. You know what I'll do? I'll kind of take you through my story a little bit.
Okay.
And then with that, we'll kind of talk to you about, you know, how do you give your life to Christ? You know, I grew up in a Catholic home. And always went to church. And, you know, when my parents got divorced, that was a hard time for me. And I didn't really understand, you know, why God would allow that to happen and how that happened and why my dad wouldn't do the things that he needed to do to keep our family together. And you know, there was a lot of anger there. And, you know, went through high school and was a pretty good kid, didn't get in a lot of trouble, loved sports, played sports all the time, and that was really my support system. That's what I relied on in high school, was sports. And when things were bad at home, I just played more sports, and I wanted to play everything I could so that I didn't have to kind of deal with those problems at home, you know, relied on that, and went to college at Michigan, got a scholarship to go kick at Michigan, and sports was what I trusted in and what I relied on. I believed in God. I knew God was real, and I believed in God, but I didn't have a personal relationship with Christ at all, and I didn't really know what that meant to have a personal relationship with Christ. I just kind of viewed God as he was up there, and he was keeping track of the good things that I did and the bad things that I did, and I wanted those good to outweigh the bad. That's how I viewed God, and went to Michigan, and my focus was to study and to play sports. And my third day at practice, I tore my quad and my kicking leg. And I was done playing. And, you know, I was heartbroken. And now the biggest point in my career at that point, my sports was taken away. And I'm on my own. I'm 2,000 miles away from my family. Now I'm a kicker who doesn't kick, so I'm pretty much nothing. I'm the bottom of the barrel at Michigan. In fact, I talked to Lloyd Carr a few years ago, and they thought I was faking. You know, they didn't even believe that I really hurt myself, and I showed them the big divot in my leg that I still have from tearing my quad. But so for 3 months, I was kind of an outcast, and they were practicing, and they were doing their season, and I couldn't practice or do anything. And, you know, so I was trying to fill that void and trying to find anything I could to fill that void. And I remember we were playing Ohio State, and I went in one day, and I just got down on my knees. I went into our indoor building by myself, and I just said, you know what, God, I don't know if I'm ever going to kick again, if this is going to heal, if I'm ever going to be able to kick and play sports, but I just want you to have control. And I didn't really even know what it was, the decision that I was making, all the implications of what it was. But I just said, I want you to have control. I don't want to be in control anymore. And if you know me, you know that I like to be in control of everything. Everyone and everything. And so that was probably the hardest decision I ever made, to just say, okay, God, I'm going to give you control. And then quickly after that, I met a guy named Bruce Dishnow, and he was running Athletes in Action at Michigan, which is kind of like Fellowship of Christian Athletes. And he came up and sat down with me and kind of talked to me about what it meant to have a personal relationship with Christ and what it meant to give your life to Christ. And, you know, was that something that I wanted to do? You know, and it was. And so we walked through saying, God, please forgive me for my sins. I trust in you. I'm going to live my life for you. I accept you into my heart. And I know that you died for me on the cross. And from going forward, I know that your blood has covered my sins, and that it's not just the good things that I did that outweigh the bad, that it's your blood that covers up all the bad that I did, and that's how I'm going to get into heaven. And, you know, for me, that was such a dramatic change in the way that I thought about God and the way that I thought about life. You know, and I go back to that verse, you know, where Paul talks about the peace that transcends all understanding. That was the biggest difference for me. Was that before that, I never had had a peace about me. And I didn't have a peace, and it was all about results. And it was all about being the best, and it was all about succeeding, and I was going to be better than everybody else, and I was going to outwork and outperform everybody. And that didn't take away any of my desire to succeed and outwork everybody and outperform everybody, but it took away the focus on results, because I knew that I had given my life to Christ, and he was in control now. And that I could have this peace that regardless of what happened with the results, that my life was given to Christ and that he was always going to be there for me and that his blood was going to cover my sins and that whether I succeeded or failed wasn't going to have an impact on God's purpose and plan for my life. And that gave me a peace that allowed me to do my best, because I wasn't consumed by results, and it took away that pressure and it took away that fear of failure.
Wow. Amen. That's wonderful. Okay. Let me say two things.
Yes.
First of all, if you had any more questions about what Jay's talking about, I'm sure you would love to talk with them and pray with them, or just counsel, whatever the case would be.
Absolutely.
And that would be good. And the second thing is, the pizza's out there. It's getting cold.
So, right. Does anybody have any questions?
Yes, before that. So we'll take a couple questions.
Yes,
or whatever.
Ma'am. Yeah, he coached basketball in Minnesota. It was St. Thomas College, and he coached there for over 30 years. He played there and then coached there.
I know you said that you had about 10 friends, but who was your best friend?
My best friend. I don't know that I could pick one. There was a guy named Reggie Hodges who punted for a couple years and lived with me. My roommate at Michigan is still a really good friend of mine, a guy named Craig Baker, which is interesting because he was a kicker as well, and we alternated. He would start, and then I would start, and then he would start, and then I would start, and they kind of alternated us back and forth, and so we were living together, and we were competing against each other, but we both had a love for Christ, and I think that allowed us to remain friends and not dislike each other, even when I was on the bench and he was starting, and then when he was on the bench and I was starting, and there was tension that was there. It's normal, but we lived together for 4 years, and we were, you know, very good friends and still remain friends to this day.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Did I ever win a game?
Yeah, a couple times I hit game-winning field goals and won the game. It was pretty cool. Anybody else? Yes, sir. Yes, I beat you in cards. Oh, that's not what you were going to ask. Jack has no problem. He can't remember how to play cribbage every time. I don't remember. How do you play this game? Then he wins. Yes, sir.
You've been around in your travels. Do you notice in the pro golf offense there's a lot of Christians in there?
In pro golf? Absolutely. And I think that, you know, again, you know, that's a very high pressure, individual performance based game. And, you know, there's so many. And I've been lucky to become friends with a lot of them out in Arizona. You know, and they do a great job in the PGA of having a Bible study for the players and their families every week at every tour stop. On Tuesdays, they'll, you know, a different guy will host it at their home. Rebecca and I have gone up to Aaron Badley's house a couple of times in Phoenix when he's had that. You know, but so many guys, Bubba Watson and Justin Leonard. I mean, I could go on and on, all these guys. Streelman, Kevin Streelman's one of my best friends in Arizona. Just really strong faiths and, you know, guys that love the Lord and compete hard, but, you know, make good decisions along the way. Yeah. No, never did. I wish I would have. Guy that I respected from afar tremendously, a guy who wasn't afraid to talk about his faith and to stand up for his faith publicly, and regardless of what people said or thought about him, you know, and just one of the greatest of all time, not just playing, but also, you know, as a Christian athlete. Yes. Yeah, you know, I mean, Tim's interesting because I think the world of him as an individual. I really do. And I think that he's stood up for his faith more than probably anybody else as an athlete and unashamed of his faith. And, you know, at the same time, he was not a very good quarterback. and I've said that and taken heat from that. Like, people are like, how could you say that? He's a Christian. Well, I'm being honest. I mean, he's not a good quarterback. He was a great college player. But as a Christian athlete, somebody that I respected tremendously and respected the way he was never shied away from his faith and always talked about it. And, you know, I mean, I don't think his failures as a pro quarterback take anything away from how great he was as a college player or, you know, how awesome he's been as an advocate for Christ. And, you know, how many people has he reached just by talking about his faith and not being ashamed of it and taking a knee when he was scoring touchdowns? And you know, I never felt any negative brushback to it. I mean, there may have been some guys that didn't want to be friends with you, or, you know, that you weren't close with, you know, because you were leading a different lifestyle and you weren't going out partying with them. But I never felt any negative brushback from any team, especially. You know, even I was on the Falcons, and our owner, Arthur Blank, was Jewish, and I remember one time he and I went for a horseback riding trip in Montana and talked for 2 hours about faith, you know, and about his Jewish faith and my Christian faith and why we believed what we believed. And, you know, I think more than anything what that did was develop a respect for each other, you know, that we were able to have have honest dialogue that was respectful from different viewpoints. And I think in our country in general today, that's one of the things that we're lacking. That we don't have honest dialogue, and we don't do it in a respectful manner when we disagree with somebody. You can disagree with somebody and be true to your beliefs while also respecting them, and I think that's something that's missing. Anybody else? You got one more? Okay, go ahead.
Did you play for 5 teams?
I played for 6 teams. 6? Yep. I used to always say, like, the team that was paying me now. But I, looking back now that none of them are paying me, I think the Falcons was my favorite team because we were closest with that group. And we had that, I talked to you about that, those 10 couples that were all young and that all hung out all the time and that had the Bible studies at our house. And it was just a really special, unique time. And we didn't know it at the time how unique and cool that was. But then when you're on other teams, you don't have those same relationships and that closeness. You realize how unique and special that was. Yeah.
What did you study at Michigan?
I studied education, and then I became a financial advisor after I was done. My cousin had played baseball for the Twins for a while, and when he got hurt and his career was over, he became a financial advisor. And he kind of talked me into to becoming a financial advisor with his firm. And so I took my test and my Series 6 and 7 and did that for a couple years until I got into the NFL. Hmm. Yes, ma'am. You got another one? Number, my favorite numbers are 2, 3, and 4, because those are the numbers that I wore. Different teams, I wore different numbers. And sometimes I sold my number. I would sell to the quarterbacks a lot of times when they came in, because they wanted my number. So I said, all right, if you make a donation to the foundation, I'll give you my number. So for the Cardinals, I wore 4, and then 3, and then 4. Thank you guys for coming so much. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you had fun, and I hope you learned something. Dear Lord, thank you so much for this night. Thank you for all the families that are here. I pray that you would protect them as they drive and head home and keep us all safe. Help us to focus on you and all we do. In Jesus' name.